I was trying to think of how I should introduce this particular topic, which is speaking truth to power. And I suppose one way is with a joke that I acquired when I was covering Eastern Europe in the days of the Cold War. One of the great things about communist countries is that they develop this incredible sardonic humor. Humor is a marvelous weapon against power, against unjust power. And in Czechoslovakia, there was a marvelous story, and I shall try to repeat the story in Czech dialect. So pardon my Czech if it's not very good. Question. Why do Czechoslovak policemen always go round in threes? Answer. One can read and the other can write. But what about the third? He watches after those two intellectuals. When Jodi Hassett gave her marvelous talk last night, I sort of swallowed hard because she began it with discussion of speaking truth to power, which is, of course, in a way, what journalists do at least some of the time, and what some of them do a lot of the time, and which defines in many ways how our profession functions. You know, journalism used to be called, or is still sometimes called, the fourth estate. And the reason it's called the fourth estate is that in Versailles in July 1789, Louis XVI summoned the three estates. The three estates general of France were 300 noblemen, 300 clergy, and 600 members of the common class, or the non-landed class. And the fourth estate became known as, I think it was Edmund Burke who first described the press corps in the House of Commons as the fourth estate. And the reason he did so was because even then, late 18th century, journalists were beginning to acquire the power that they have to affect society. And often that power, of course, has been quite destructive. One of the reasons why people are so critical of the media is that at its worst, it's awful. It's sensationalistic, it's inaccurate, it's biased, it spreads prejudices against different groups in society. But at its best, the media, journalists, reporters, can be incredibly helpful implements to redress the injustices of society. We have in our midst at this conference one journalist, Shaila Koshi from Malaysia, who is precisely an example of somebody who is trying to bring justice to a society which is squeezing harder and harder on personal freedoms, and particularly freedom of the media. And when she goes back to Malaysia, she is not entirely sure what will happen to her because she has refused to reveal the source of a report which came into her hands that profoundly affected events in Malaysia. Now, even in the United States, a country in which the press is really completely free, journalists have gone to prison recently for contempt of court because they refused to reveal who told them what was going on. And this is actually an honorable tradition. Some of you may not know that the first English language journalists or the first English language newspaper reporters were Puritan clergy who were dismissed from their jobs by the court of Charles I for wanting to purify worship in the Puritan way in their churches. And they were removed from their living. That is, they lost their jobs as clergymen in Anglican churches, and they started writing about it. And that led to an incredible growth of newspapers, newsletters in England in the 1620s, 30s, and 40s. 1640s, the time of the civil war between Parliament and King Charles, was one of the periods of the most exciting freedom of the press in England. And it all started because Puritan clergy, who were very concerned about telling the truth, had been removed from their jobs and wanted to redress this injustice. Last night we heard Peter Doherty, who told us a fact that I think we're all aware of, that being a Christian is extremely dangerous in some parts of the world, and being a journalist is also extremely dangerous. So being a Christian journalist may be a double jeopardy. In the year 2007, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is a New York-based organization, 65 journalists around the world were killed while pursuing their profession. Now, about half those were killed in Iraq, and all except one of those killed in Iraq were actually Iraqis. So being an Iraqi journalist is an extremely dangerous thing to be. Another organization, Journalists Without Borders, which is based in Paris, put the number of those killed in 2007 as 86. And yet another organization, the World Association of Newspapers, which tries to protect newspaper reporters from being murdered, said that the number was 95. Probably hundreds more journalists are in prison because they wrote something that their governments did not like. Unfortunately, the largest number of journalists in prison is actually China, where there are 29 journalists who have been arrested for various infractions of government regulations on reporting. And in 2006, here is a name that every journalist, every reporter ought to know about and to think about on a fairly regular basis. One of the most courageous victims of murder, because she was pursuing her profession with diligence and integrity, was the Russian journalist Anna Politkovskaya. Now, some of you may have heard that name, and we should all know it, because Anna Politkovskaya was a Russian journalist who reported on human rights violations in Russia, and particularly in Chechnya. Her reporting was extremely courageous. She experienced innumerable death threats from unspecified people. She was on a plane to Beslan, where, as you may recall, Chechen gunmen took over a school and murdered hundreds of school children. And she was on a plane to report that, and she was poisoned, probably by the Federal Security Bureau, which is the domestic successor organization of the KGB on internal politics. And she kept on writing, she kept on reporting. She got threats from supporters of the head, the Russian appointed head of Chechnya, Kadyrov, who warned her that if she kept on reporting his alleged misdoings, she would be murdered. And she was. She was murdered in the elevator of her own apartment by a gunman who coolly entered the elevator in full view of surveillance cameras and shot her at point-blank range. It was an absolutely an appalling murder, and it probably had the fingerprints on it somewhere of Vladimir Putin, whose fingerprints were also probably on the murder of Litvinenko, another Russian dissident who had been exiled in London. Journalists are not an endangered species. but they are a species of professional in danger. And we need to know why and how we should respond to this threat to colleagues in the profession, and particularly as we are Christians. Many journalists, not necessarily of Christian faith, are attracted to the profession, and I forgive me for calling it a profession. I think it is a profession. I know that here in Australia people call it the industry, but industry sounds like grubby overalls and workbenches and things. And I prefer to call it a professional, sort of white-collar stuff. Anyway, forgive that foolish prejudice. But many journalists are attracted to the profession, particularly young people in college. They want to go to journalism school. Why? Again and again, it's because they want to, quote, clean up City Hall. Now, what does that mean? It means exposing injustice, corruption, wrongdoing in news organizations, which supposedly would lead to efforts to reform, to clean out the organization, etc. And indeed, that has been the experience of many journalists. They have successfully cleaned up City Hall. The problem with this motivation for going into journalism is, if you are not a Christian, you are very quickly transformed from an idealist to a cynic. Why? Because as a journalist who is purely an idealist, you think, oh, well, I will reveal the truth, and then the good guys will come in, the good judges, the police, the investigators, whatever, and they'll sort out this problem, and there will be reform. But what happens is idealistic journalists start nosing around City Hall. That's just kind of shorthand for places of power in government. And they start asking questions of government bureaucrats. And quite soon in their career, they will be lied to. Somebody will tell them a lie. Now, I assume an awful lot of you have had that experience as reporters. People have lied to you. And it's devastating. It's incredibly insulting. It's humiliating. And it gives you a sense of outrage and even violation. How could this person tell me something that is he knows is not the truth? And when you get told a lie, if you are not a Christian, you tend to jump to the conclusion that every government bureaucrat always tells lies all the time, which, of course, is an absurd generalization. But you can see how the emotional response to being lied to drives you to infer that. In other words, you can't trust anybody in government. And so if you're a journalist who follows that route, you end up being a very cynical person, and I think a cynical journalist is probably not a very good journalist most of the time. The reason I say that Christians have a huge advantage in journalism is twofold. The first is they know that human nature is flawed. Original sin makes human beings inherently driven to sin. They do bad things. They tell lies. They take bribes, etc., etc. So we Christians should not and generally are not particularly surprised when people in government do bad things, including telling lies, because we know that we're all sinners, and people who have power are often more dangerous sinners than the rest of us. The second reason that we have an advantage as Christians in this profession is that we believe there is such a thing as truth. Now, we don't necessarily think we will always find the truth, or we will find the whole truth, or what we write will be nothing but the truth. But we believe truth is out there, and it is beholden to us as reporters to the rest of society to pursue it as diligently as we can. how do reporters relate to power? Dominic gave us a very interesting example and a very, I thought, edifying example of being a young reporter, somewhat intimidated by his first week experience of a new job, going to a farewell party for an editor and being forced to attend a strip party, a stripper's appearance at a party. And rather courageously, he tried initially to be in a position not to have to go at all, but when he was stuck, then he sort of diligently looked at the carpet and so forth. I think that's a very good example of how we as reporters often have to struggle with how we relate to the power of our own bosses. We don't particularly want to get fired. We want to please them. We want to do a good job. We want to comply, on the whole, with their wishes. I didn't, fortunately, have any such demand on me as to attend a farewell party where there was a stripper attendant. But I do recall one situation many years ago in India in 1975 when Prime Minister Indira Gandhi declared emergency rule. There were a number of reporters who had come into Delhi to report that situation. And after a couple of days, the government of India issued a demand to all foreign correspondents in the country. The demand was that they sign a paper which said, I, as a journalist, will obey the censorship regulations of the government of India. Well, nobody quite knew what the censorship regulations were. So, in effect, the government of India was trying to get foreign journalists to agree to self-censorship. Now, it's very interesting. The Foreign Press Corps in Delhi fell into two camps. The first camp said, oh, this is just some stupid government piece of paper. Sign it and ignore it. In other words, sign a promise that you know you're not going to keep because it's a ridiculous promise, or it's a coerced promise. But the other part, the other half of the journalists into which I fell was, no, I am not going to sign a piece of paper which I have no intention of implementing. I'm not going to agree to censor my own reporting. I'm going to report what I see as the truth. And those who refused to sign were ordered to leave India. And before I got the 3 o'clock knock on the door by the special branch of the New Delhi police, I actually hopped on a plane and left because I knew that they would be knocking on my door if I stayed, having refused to sign that piece of paper. Well, I'm relieved to know that my then colleague in Hong Kong, who didn't have any such qualms about signing a piece of paper he had no intention of observing, arrived a couple of days later to fill my position and promptly got mugged and had his passport stolen in Calcutta, which was, I thought, a small amount of vindication for the decision that that I had taken. Sometimes we get intimidated by people who make threats, legal threats against us, not fortunately physical threats, but legal threats can sometimes be fairly intimidating. I remember in the 1980s when I was reporting events in Israel, our bureau decided that one of the things we wanted to do was to take a public opinion poll of West Bank Palestinians. What did they think about Syria? What did they think about the PLO? What did they think about the Israeli military administration, etc.? This was before the Oslo Accords when the Israelis partially withdrew. And we hired a reputable Israeli public opinion poll who in turn hired reputable Palestinian poll takers who they trained and who spoke Arabic and of course were native to the West Bank, and they sent them off to do their reporting. It was a very interesting report that they filed. Unfortunately, the last pollster who was asking his last question in one of the West Bank cities got spotted by an Israeli patrol who then arrested him, questioned him, found out that he had a mild criminal record. He'd thrown a rock at an Israeli jeep or something, and followed the trail of evidence of where it led, and that led to the Israeli pole company in Tel Aviv, and then it led back to us. And I remember getting a call from the Israeli military administrator of the West Bank saying, "You have done this pole. We will not allow this pole ever to see the light of day." And I thought, okay, ever's an interesting word. And so we initiated legal proceedings. The corporation for which I was working at the time initiated legal proceedings. And I remember having to drive down to Tel Aviv and make a deposition before a lawyer. And amazingly, I remember praying all the way down, amazingly, the legal proceedings actually won out, and the Israeli military authorities had no control over what we could report. And sure enough, the following week, we released the report, which was fascinating and didn't do any particular harm to the Israeli government. I mean, the objections voiced by the military administrator were quite invalid. But I'm just saying that because pressure on you, power over you, can take various forms. And sometimes it can be very frightening, as in the case of people who are reporting dangerous situations and experience death threats. Most of the murders of journalists around the world are because journalists have reported crimes. Many journalists have been killed in Colombia because they reported on the activities of the drug cartels. A famous journalist was murdered in Ireland in broad daylight because she was doing exactly the same. She was reporting what the drug bandits were doing in the country of Ireland. So we live and work within a profession that has inherent risks. Most of us, most of the time, will not be reporting those kinds of things. But I suggest, as Christians in this profession, those of us who feel in some way called into it, we should be prepared on occasion to take a courageous stand. That is, to put possibly even our own lives in jeopardy out of a belief that what we are doing is important and could lead to greater justice in the world. Those C-17s make a lot of noise. One of the most remarkable and interesting cases of reporters speaking truth to power is the Watergate affair in the United States. For those of you who were not even sparkles in your parents' eyes, Watergate is an affair that started in June 1973 when five burglars were interrupted trying to break into the offices of the Democratic Party National Committee in the Watergate building in Washington. I remember it very well because I was a young reporter in Washington at the time. And I remember it was promptly dismissed by the Nixon administration spokesman as a third-rate burglary. And I remember most of us, including myself, thought that it would go no further than a sort of scandal for a couple of weeks. And I remember our bureau chief at the time, a very remarkable, insightful reporter, Hugh Seide, saying, "Now hold on, hold on. This could just unravel the presidency of the United States." And everybody thought, Hugh Seide, he's going mad. I mean, why is he speculating? And sure enough, it turned out that there were connections between the burglars and an organization called CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President. Wonderful name for such an organization. And it turned out that the connections went very high up in the White House, and sure enough, Richard Nixon, then the President of the United States, was himself involved in trying to suppress investigations of who had ordered this break-in. And as you, some of you may remember, the two heroes of the investigative reporting that broke the story were Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein of the Washington Post, for whom the Pulitzer Prize was granted because of their reporting. And one of their sources revealed many years later, they referred to as Deep Throat. This fellow, Deep Throat, was actually the deputy director of the FBI, and he'd risked certainly his career, if not possibly his life, in order to reveal the truth to these reporters. Now, where does that get us? If we look at the history of journalism, reporters have not always been under such physical threat as many of them are today in many parts of the world, but they have been under other kinds of threats. And the reason they have always come under threats is because one of the callings of a reporter, I believe, is to speak the truth. To speak the truth to the society, which means speaking the truth to the government and speaking the truth to whoever is in power. Many people here have forgotten how important the reportings of, just to take the United States alone, the so-called muckrakers in the late 19th century who broke stories on the appalling conditions of workers in factories, in sweatshops, sewing clothes for hours a day and living in unspeakable conditions. One reporter, an American reporter, Nellie Bly, and she later went to work for Mr. Pulitzer, who started the Pulitzer Prize, she posed as an insane person in order to live inside one of the notorious insane asylums in New York, and she reported on how absolutely appalling the conditions were. Food that was infested by rats, beatings of inmates, incarceration of inmates for totally trivial reasons by vindictive relatives, all sorts of things like that. And her reports led to improvements in the whole mental health system in New York that led to great reforms. And that is the correct role of reporters much of the time. Now, what are the obstacles to doing this and to fulfilling our roles? Well, some of them are indeed physical fear. I think it's justifiable to feel fear if somebody threatens you. But some of the reasons are less noble. Sometimes we reporters get lazy. We don't bother to look just a little deeper. Sometimes we get swayed by conventional wisdom or conventional bias. And I believe one of our callings is always to question ourselves and our colleagues and conventional wisdom in order to find out the truth. If we as Christian reporters overlook the truth, who is likely to find it and to report it to the society in such a way that society, wherever possible, can change its ways? Now, does that mean being insolent or disrespectful of those in power or those in authority? I don't think so. I've looked at many of the instances in the Bible, and some of them, of course, in the wonderful Bible studies given by Dominic already, about people who spoke to power. For example, the prophet Daniel, when he was locked in the lion's den for refusing to stop praying, as his adversaries wanted him to do. When he was released from the lion's den, or at least when the king, King Darius, came in the morning to see if he had survived this ordeal, and sure enough, Daniel had, protected, of course, by angels. The first thing Daniel said to King Darius was not, "You blankety blankety blank tyrant, see that your foul designs on my life were not answered by these lions." He said, "O king, live forever." A sign of great respect to somebody who, under the persuasion of corrupt and evil-minded officials, had signed a very unjust law. King David, when he was running away from, not King David, at the time he was just David, when he was running away from King Saul, Saul was jealous of the respect that David had acquired in society, was highly respectful to the man who held life and death power over him, even though that king, King Saul, was very unjust. You remember that when David was on the run, at one time King Saul was pursuing him, and King Saul was relieving himself in a cave, and David crept up and cut off a piece of his clothing to prove that he had power if he wanted to kill the king. And then he was conscience-struck, the Bible tells us in 1 Samuel 24. He was conscience-stricken for having cut off a corner of King Saul's robe. And then he reveals himself to the king and he says, "My lord the king." And the Bible says, 24:8 of 1 Samuel, "When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground." And in verse 13, "May the Lord be the one to judge between us. May he vindicate my cause and uphold it." Notice he didn't say, "You blankety blank king, what are you doing chasing after me? You're a total scoundrel and you'll come to no good." And again at Gibeah, when David and Abishai crept into King Saul's camp and planted a spear by the bed of King Saul when he was asleep, again proving that David had great power over the king, but when he had the power, did not do harm. King David, or David, went to the other side of the valley, called out, and Paul recognizes his voice, and he says, "Is that your voice, David, my son?" And David replied, "Yes, it is, my lord the king." So he's highly respectful, and we should be highly respectful to the people we report on, even if, and maybe especially if we respect, that they are doing wrong things, that they are part of a corruption network or a bribery network or an injustice network. We should be polite, but we should tell the truth. That is our calling, to speak the truth to them. Even Jesus, when confronted by Pilate, "Are you the king of the Jews?" It's very interesting, the three synoptic gospels, especially at least in the NIV translation, have Jesus saying exactly the same thing to the question. Mark 15:2, Matthew 27:11, Luke 23:3, "Yes, it is as you say." Now in the John version, Pilate says, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "Is that your own idea, or did others talk to you about it?" And Pilate says, well, he doesn't know anything about Jewish law. And then Jesus, in verse 36 of John 18, says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is of another place." It's very interesting that Pilate's response to this final answer by Jesus is, "You are a king then." That's the only thing Pilate seemed to be interested in finding out. Jesus replies, verse 37, "You are right in saying I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." Insofar as we reporters who are Christian believers, who are called into the profession of journalism, are followers of Jesus, we are called to testify to the truth. And often that truth is extremely unpleasant for people in power, for the leaders of society, for the leaders of government, and yet we must say it. Often we must say it when it goes against our greatest personal prejudices. But we must say it because it is the truth. And so when Burke referred to journalists as the fourth estate, he understood that reporters doing the right thing can be a very powerful force for health in any society. We are the thin membrane defending society from falsehood and from self-deception. It's very important that we take our jobs very seriously. Not ourselves, I don't think anybody should take himself seriously, but we should take our profession seriously. We should take our calling seriously. We as Christians are called to speak the truth, and that truth may be painful, horrible, may result in very difficult responses to us, but we must do it. One of the great examples of a journalist, in fact, many journalists have written books that have changed the way societies view some of their internal problems. One of the greatest journalists of the 20th century was Émile Zola. Émile Zola was the French journalist who was convinced that Alfred Dreyfus, who was the French officer unjustly court-martialed for allegedly being a spy when he wasn't a spy, and he was court-martialed purely because he was Jewish and a portion of the French military was totally prejudiced against Jews. Émile Zola wrote a magnificent letter which was published on the front page of a French newspaper. And the headline of the letter was, "J'accuse, I accuse." He wasn't, as far as I know, a Christian believer, but he was responding to the impulse of justice in speaking truth to men of power. And Émile Zola's letter was a powerful factor influencing the French government to review again the Dreyfus case, and finally to vindicate Dreyfus. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, that is our calling. Most of us, most of the time, will not be confronted with a Dreyfus case or Watergate or a case of gross human rights violations as Anna Politkovskaya was trying to uncover in Chechnya. But in small and significant ways, our calling is to be diligent in digging a little deeper than our neighbor reporter who is not a Christian. Being a little more diligent than we would be if we succumbed to our desire to goof off, as we all do from time to time. We fulfill an important role in protecting society, in speaking truth to power, in speaking truth to our colleagues, and in speaking truth to society itself. I think it's a wonderful thing to be a believer in this great profession, and I think as long as we continue to bear those things in mind, we, in our capacity as believers, will continue to bring honor to this profession.